Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Black Tooth Geordie.
And I'm your other host, Merciless Duncan. Oh, those are northern names.
And Geordie's already a pretty northern name.
Duncan's a Scottish name, mate. It's not necessary, but here we are. Ready to embrace the spirit.
So, if you hadn't picked up so far, we are reading, we're jumping back into the, what do you even call it? The Blade itself?
The First Law.
Series? What is it called?
It's the First Law.
The First Law, of course.
Universe. It's a bit confusing. We've got the First Law trilogy, and then they sort of just call the rest of the series the First Law Universe series. Doesn't have a cool name.
Because this is the second book in the second series within the First Law Chronicles.
That's right, by Joe Abercrombie. We started by reading the first book in the second series, Best Served Cold, earlier this year. It was a great time. Now, I have already read the original trilogy, and I intentionally got Geordie not to read that first, partly because I don't think the Blade itself is that amazing, or at least as amazing as the books that come afterwards. And also, the marketing has always pushed that you can read the second series without reading the first one, and I want to test it out on Geordie.
And I think we definitely found that was pretty true in the first one. Like, it was amusing in some ways, because it took me a pretty good portion of the book to realize that the Bloody Nine was Logan Ninefingers. They were the same person. I didn't realize that at first, and a character called the Cripple, who I thought was like just like a background character that people sometimes talked about. Oh no, that's a main character. So that was funny. But I think I did just like get to enjoy the book, and I didn't need to do any homework beforehand. However, Duncan, I really don't think that you could read this second book without having read the one before it. And also, we haven't said yet, we're reading The Heroes, the one that comes after Best Served Cold. But I have no idea how you were able to read this book before you read Best Served Cold, Duncan.
Yes, that's the point. I read The Heroes before I read Best Served Cold, mostly because I knew that The Heroes was set in the bit of this universe, you know, called the North, where the barbarians are fighting the colonialist powers of the Union, who are continually trying to expand into their territory. And that was my favourite bit of the setting from the original trilogy. So I went, right, I'm going straight in for The Heroes. And I'll tell you now, Geordie, I read it absolutely fine. Genuinely, the bits that reference Best Served Cold meant nothing to me. Because I thought, this book would be harder to read if you hadn't read the original trilogy. Because so many of the characters in this book, like Black Dow, Bethod, the Dogman, they're all heavily featured in that original trilogy. So how did you get on?
And I didn't have any problem following the story. I wasn't sure to what extent certain characters were important. Like, because I'd read Best Served Cold, I knew the Bloody Nine is a big deal. I'm like, okay, the fact these people are talking about having, like, killed the Bloody Nine, or we've been on the same side as him, I guess, here's the thing. I said that, and I'm like, oh, is that a spoiler? But the funny thing is that, like, I have no idea if it is, because I think Black Dow might just be lying about that. Like, that's the great thing about this book, is people say so much bullshit that isn't true, and I'm like, are you just making that up? Did that actually happen in the books, or not? I have no idea.
I'm going to tell you now, for this point reading the universe, you're not meant to know. That is actually very intentional on the behalf of the author.
So that's interesting. I'm glad I'm having the right experience. The bit which I think that's like, because you read this book, did you know who Cole Shivers was when you first read this book?
The character of Cole Shivers is a side character in the original trilogy and one of the main characters in Best Served Cold. And reading this book before Best Served Cold, I had no idea what had happened to this poor guy. Because when you leave
this
character,
what the fuck happened to you?
In the end of the original trilogy, he kind of goes off with a bit of a hopeful smile and I'm going to have a better life. And then reading The Heroes, it's like he's missing an eye, he's heavily scarred, and he's like, I'm having the worst time ever. And I'm like, oh dear God, things were bad. But I also didn't know, Geordie, that that mm-hmm. happened on page. Because I didn't know the plot of Best Served Cold. I was like, maybe it was meant to happen off page. And I'll also tell you this for nothing. I forgot, between reading The Heroes and reading Best Served Cold, that Cole Shivers is in The Heroes. Like, I genuinely read Best Served Cold, completely forgetting that he shows up later, horribly scarred and diminished.
Well, that's good. It didn't ruin your experience of Best Served Cold then, because you forgot. The bit I think is would be let down, and this is just because I've read Best Served Cold, and I can't imagine someone not having read Best Served Cold before this, but the stuff with Gorst and his humiliation, which happens as a really minor event in Best Served Cold, it becomes one of the main plot points of this book, that one of our big heroes, like, has to redeem himself because of shit that happened in the previous book. And you're supposed to be like, oh my god, him and Cole Shivers, the guy who just so happened to cause that downfall.
Spoilers, Jordy.
Okay, you're right. Okay, no spoilers yet. But they're on the same battlefield and you're waiting for them to run into each other and for, is he going to realize that it's him? And it's really interesting how that plays out. But to begin with, no spoilers. And to begin with more, Duncan, because we ask each other this every time, have you been reading anything else?
No. This has been enough for me. Reading The Heroes has been an absolute experience, and it's literally all my time is dedicated to it.
Yeah, and the same goes for me. I actually thought I wasn't going to be able to make it through because it is a chunky book, but I managed to, by a combination of reading both the physical book and the audiobook on Spotify, and it really was perfect because the book itself is way too long for the 15-hour limit Spotify gives you to read a book for free. But because I also owned a physical book, I sort of just jumped back and forth between them based on where I was. So if I was in bed, I would read the book. And if I was going to work, I would listen to the audiobook. And I was like, okay, great. I've got the best of both worlds. And you need to have the physical book. This is the first time, I think, in the whole podcast, I'm like, you literally cannot get by without having the physical book, because this one has something pretty unique to it. A lot of fantasy novels have maps at the front. Most of the time, they're pointless. This is the least pointless a map has ever been in a fantasy novel.
That's right, Geordie. I even remember having to tell you about this. You were like, oh, what's the importance? I was like, no, it's so critical. Because this map, it doesn't even show like a massive area. It's not like a continent. It's the map of the very close-knit battlefield that this book almost entirely focuses on. But what's really important is that throughout the book, this map gets updated for the reader as troops move about the battlefield. And this is so important for the plot. Like, Joe Abercrombie, as well, literally, you can see it. He is mapping it out for you. And the whole focus of this fight is that he is mapping it out every step. If a guy's over there, he is never going to have a conversation with the bloke standing over there. You know, it is beat by beat, step by step, hour by hour, mapped out.
Yes. And more so, like, there's a really strong emphasis in this book on literally the strategies which characters are employing. It's a book about war. But it's not like a Saving Private Ryan book. It doesn't try and say war is bad by showing how gruesome it can be. It shows that war is bad because it's tedious and it's stupid. And so you get down to the minutiae of troops moving around on this little board and then sitting there and waiting for days on end. One of the characters in this book, and now I guess we're going to get into characters, is Corporal Tunney. And the great thing about Corporal Tunney is that he's the most experienced soldier in the entire book. He's only a corporal, he's not a general, and he's not like a war chief like on the northern side. But what he is that he's just a guy who's been in the army for a really long time and will do whatever it takes to not have to fight.
I love this character. I love the fact that we're going straight into like the structure. But, like, we prep them for like, yeah, this, we're going to hit all the main POV characters. And Jordy, we haven't even said if we really endorse the book. Do you endorse the book? Do you like this book?
Oh yeah, this is a great book. I don't know if it's as good as Best Served Cold. I think the heights of this book are better than the heights of Best Served Cold, but it has a slightly slow ending, and Best Served Cold had a great ending, so I think it's just edging it out.
Absolutely fair enough. I fully agree with your assessment. I love this book. I really enjoy the individual characters that we see. I think its message on war is beautifully delivered, but I think you're also right. It wasn't as consistently rip-roaring. Best Served Cold is excellent because it's quite episodic. We go and have all these like mini adventures, harkening back to those sort of short story, action, sword and sorcery that I adore. This one, it plays out a little slower. It really gives you those lulls in combat. In a weird way, it kind of reminds me of like reading like Master and Commander. We have long stretches of book where it's kind of like a bit more chill. And then though, that just makes the moments of actual heightened action just all the more intense.
This is a book where, for the most part, aside from some really major characters, there is a strong feeling of fatality. You know, you really believe that when a fight starts, okay, people, important characters are going to die. I'm going to see it happen, and it's not going to be retconned out of the way. Really, actually, what you can count on most of all is not that characters will die, it's just that characters will be miserable.
I think that's a really solid outtake. Live or die, they're having a bad day. And I think that brings us right back.
Anytime I wanted to predict what would happen next in the story, I was just like, what would make Gorst unhappy? And I just decided that would happen, and I was always correct.
And what we see of this battle is, as mentioned before, there are six key POVs throughout the book that we keep jumping between on both sides of the conflict. And then bringing that back to Tunny, one of the minor POVs, I'd actually say, in terms of impacting events, but very good at giving you that, probably the lowliest soldier's outlook, probably, I think.
Aside from random POVs we occupy, yes, he's basically the lowest ranking dude. Like, even a guy who starts off the story, Craw starts off and he seems like a pretty unimportant guy, but he ends up being super important by the end.
So, very true. Geordie, actually, before we jump back to Tunny, I know we're darting about like madmen. I think I do need to just lay down this conflict a little bit more clearly, and then we can jump between sides.
Fair enough.
So, the heroes, named after a sort of Stonehenge kind structure on top of a hill on the north side of a river. And approaching upon it, we have two parties. The Northmen, led by Blackdale, the most recent king of the North. Not a very nice man, not very well liked. And from the south, we have Union, which is the traditional Roman British colonial power that's pushing up into these.
Right, you've got barbarity versus civilization.
That's definitely one way to put it. And this real conflict, I mean, I'm not even 100% sure why they're fighting each other. I think the Union have taken some land and the Northmen want it back. Some people just want to fight. It's just what you do. It's revealed later
on. Yeah, absolutely. It's all about like the Union trying to seize like some important land and ultimately, the point is that it's basically pointless. Like, the characters are doing this because of like almost bureaucratic stagnation. Like, they could achieve a lot if they were able to talk, but Black Dow can't just like acquiesce to any demand from Union because it would make him look weak, so he has to fight even though it's pointless. No one's actually fighting over the territory where they're meeting. It's not like they're fighting in order to have the heroes. The heroes are pointless. It's just a well defendable location, so the Northerners are like, okay, let's stand here and let them come to us. And throughout the book, you've got these intelligent political characters who are saying, you know, warfare is the least profitable and it's the least effective form of getting things done. But we're doing it anyway.
Well, that's nicely summed up. Back to Tunny. Tunny's great because Tunny realises this. And Tunny wants to stay alive.
He has no time for heroics.
Exactly. He's left that. That's for the young and the dead heroics. Tony's here to technically fulfill his orders and not die doing it.
And what I like about this is that, like, recently I've started listening to a couple of, like, podcasts that aren't really about war, but just so happen to be run by guys who used to be in the US Army. And so occasionally they'll sprinkle in an anecdote about, like, being in Afghanistan or Iraq. And the overwhelming impression you get is that so much of the time spent there is just sitting in your hands, waiting, not doing anything. Certainly not doing anything of real importance. And this book really captures, especially in Tunney's sections, that it's very tedious stuff. Like, we won't get into proper spoilers on Tunney's section, but Tunney spends about 4 days standing in the same spot, not doing anything. And that's not like a critique of the book and saying, oh, this book's boring because Tunney doesn't do anything. No, that's the point, and it's interesting, and it's funny. And it's observant.
It's weirdly the closest thing to almost like a Terry Pratchett character. Maybe that's quite an out there thing to say about Joe Abercrombie's writing. But this is...
No, but you're right. The tone is somewhat different, of course. But, like, this is just like a Sam Vimes with, like, a couple more scales on the jaded, you know, the jaded radar.
And he's really enjoyable to read. But as you kind of said, and kind of why we're addressing him first, because he stands a lot of time just sitting there making his observations and being amusing, I think he's very much good for the pacing of the book. It sort of brings levity from when you're reading maybe another section with some pretty intense emotional gut punches throughout. It's like, oh, thank goodness we're back with Tunney. Not today, though, Geordie. I don't know if you felt this on your first read. I remember feeling this quite a lot on my first read. Is I actually got quite a lot of anxiety in the later parts of the book with Tunney. I was like, oh, no. Is it going to go really wrong for him at the last minute?
No, I completely predicted what was going to happen with Tunney, like, basically from, like, the third time he showed up. I can't explain that without getting into spoilers, so shall we hold off and get back to that later?
Absolutely. Let's move on to another really enjoyable character.
Let's hop the fence and let's talk about the other side.
So, on the Northman side, we have some really interesting characters here. So I said there's six overall kind of main POV characters. They're not quite evenly split, are they? Oh, no, actually they are. Sorry, being an idiot. Yes, they are evenly split. So on the Northman side, we have the young boy, Beck, who's just left home for the first time, taking
right,
his father's
yes,
sword.
Beck, of course.
And he's off. He's just drunk on the stories that the old men tell round the fire of his father's heroics and the honour and glory to be won on the battlefield.
Yeah, and his father's great story of heroics is, much like a lot of people, getting killed by the Bloody Nine.
Completely. Geordie, I just want to know, like, what is your impression of the Bloody Nine at this point? Like, how does he stand in your mind?
My impression is that, and listen, I love being in the position of only having heard about this character by reputation, never having seen his own perspective, never actually seeing anyone up close in first person say, I'm looking him dead in the face and this is what I think. And what I love about this is that I get the impression that he has this extremely dark reputation, which stands on top of probably a much more intricate and maybe a bit more soulful character. The thing which people keep mentioning he says a lot is, you have to be realistic. And what I get the feeling of is that he's someone who does extremely dark, violent things because he feels like he has to, like he's driven to do it. And he probably spends a lot of his time kind of feeling bad about that he has to do it, but he can't break the pattern of behavior which leads him to keep repeating these violent actions again and again and again.
Honestly, Geordie, that's a pretty fantastic summation of the character.
Hooray! I understand fantasy novels. He's not Cole Shivers in this book, where he's just, I don't care, I enjoy being violent because I need some sense of power and control in my life. No, that's not the impression I get of him at all. Although it's what other people might say about him.
Oh, definitely.
Nonetheless.
So,
nonetheless, with Beck, Beck is a character who looks up to guys like the Bloody Nine, who killed his dad, and he's like, hell yeah, I'd like to be like that. He's drunk off the ideas of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a hero, what it means to be a soldier, and he's eager to sign up when, like, the people come around to, like, draft him into the army. And his story is the least funny. It's probably the darkest, and it's definitely the most on the nose in terms of being an anti-war book. This is the Saving Private Ryan bit.
I'm inclined to agree. This is where it really rolls out to one character how traumatizing combat can be. There's quite a few characters in this book who are completely desensitized to violence, and if all your characters are like that, then the book becomes desensitized to violence, and you as the reader then become desensitized to what the book's describing. So I think it's great to have Beck there as a very, to be honest, relatable and probably my own perspective character on what's going on.
Sure, exactly. Beck should be the insight. He should be the person who you read this book and you're like, I kind of want to be, you know, like one of the cool, calm, collected, badass characters. Most of whom we don't actually get like an internal monologue on, with the exception being Gorst, who's the opposite of Beck in every way, pretty much. But you're supposed to think, damn, I probably would end up being Beck, wouldn't I? Beck's experiences of battle are harrowing, and more than that, it's not even that it's like, oh, it's dark. It's the fact that he's completely inert and powerless. He's incapable of taking any action once the sword starts swinging. He's so paralyzed by fear. Again, something the characters keep saying in this book is that war is either boring and tedious, or I can't remember what exactly say it looks like. It's like arse-openingly scary.
Sounds about right.
So yeah, he's paralyzed by fear. Like, it's a physical reaction. He doesn't get, you know, fight. He gets freeze.
I mean, I think he's lucky he doesn't get flight, or his own side would probably have cut him down.
If he had chosen flight, he probably would have ended up in a much better state by the end of the novel. I love what he happens in his later scenes after. You know what, Duncan, actually, I think we kind of have to drop a spoiler thing, because if we need to discuss, like, characters and why they work, I think we are going to have to get past the... We can't just circle back and do everyone again after we cross over, like, the arbitrary spoiler barrier.
I think that's very fair.
So, before we go any further, Duncan, do you recommend this book?
Yes, obviously I recommend this book. Anyone who listened to our Best Served Co episode probably would have been able to guess I was going to have to recommend this book as well, because it's fantastically written. If you like Best Served Cold, you'll like The Heroes. If you haven't read anything, I actually think you could read The Heroes, but you should at least read Best Served Cold. You don't need to read the first trilogy. It is not necessary. But The Heroes...
Yeah, and with this one in particular, it works so well as a standalone, and Duncan, you can attest to that, because you hadn't read Best Served Cold before this, and I haven't read any of the Blade itself. Not the Blade itself, but...
First Lord Trilogy.
The First Lord Trilogy. I keep wanting to say Sword of Truth.
The First Very Lord different Trilogy. Vibes.
So yes, it works as a standalone. And so much so that if you don't even read fantasy novels, and for some reason you're listening to this podcast... If you don't really like, but if you like sci-fi novels that have like action elements, you should read this. If you like Tom Clancy novels or Bernard Cornwell novels or Patrick O'Brien novels, you should read this, because it's the lowest fantasy we've ever read. Period. Full stop. We don't even get any of those vampire super soldiers in this one.
The nail you hit there with Bernard Cornwell. Like, if you read Bernard Cornwell and you read his Saxon stories, this may just be the best step from historical fiction into low fantasy you could ever take.
No doubt. In some ways, it's more Bernard Cornwell than Bernard Cornwell stories. Like, Bernard Cornwell loves talking about, you know, a flanking maneuver and a shield wall. But, like, you can actually see the lines on the battlefield in this one. Anyway, we recommend.
So, back to Beck. Beck, later to be known as Redbeck.
Hell yeah.
I talked about emotional gut punch, I talked about emotional gut punches earlier. Geordie, I think this is one of the first really good ones in the book. The first absolute moments of, oh my God, I can't believe you went there, Joe.
Yeah.
How could you?
When this moment happened in the book, I was so shocked that I immediately texted Duncan. And I genuinely think, of all the books we've done so far, nothing has actually made me go, like this.
That is high praise indeed. Geordie, tell our readers, listeners, this is a podcast audio thing. What happened?
So Beck is in his first battle, and all of his comrades downstairs, who are like teenagers and children, by the way, are being murdered.
They're held up in a house then.
Are held up
so
in a
house.
They're
downstairs.
They're being murdered by
He's
Union
upstairs.
Soldiers. Beck cannot bring himself to intervene. He can't bring himself to go down and join the fight, even though he's the biggest, even though he's the strongest. He just stays upstairs. And then, as he hears the fight come to an end, he gets up and he hides in a closet. And then, whilst he's hiding in this closet, he hears the padding of feet as a soldier comes up from downstairs. And he sees through the crack a Union sword. And finally, as he's mustering the fear that he needs to live so he can finally do the first action of the war, he bursts out of the closet and he runs the guy through with his sword. And it's not a Union soldier. It's one of his comrades. The only one who was able to actually like stand his ground and win and kill four Union soldiers, like an actual bona fide hero, gets run through by his own side. And that character is the only person that Beck ever kills.
This is heart-wrenching on so many levels. Like, you've got Beck's own sense of guilt. You've got the sort of injustice of the character he kills. I believe his name is Wreck.
Reft.
The fact that this guy should be the hero. He's just made himself a legend. He was the young kid who took on, outnumbered 4-1. And then what I love about going after this scene is then Beck can't bring himself to tell people what happened and just ends up, he doesn't like take the glory. He just lets them pile it on him.
And he's so ashamed. Like, they give him a cool name, Red Beck, which is a sick name. Because of all the blood he was covered in when they found him, which was his pal's blood. And he never uses the name Red Beck. Like, he can't bring himself to. People ask his name and he says, "It's Beck, I'm Beck." And for the rest of the story, he stays in a, numb state where he just lets people do whatever they want. He's piled into a fight at the end. But there are, a couple of things that really set him apart from the rest of the book. Because what you're waiting for after this is you're going to see, okay, how does Joe Abercrombie handle this character? He's been traumatized by war. At the moment where you expect he's finally going to come into his own. I talked a couple of weeks back that I was reading Red Storm Rising by Tom Clancy. And there's this bit where this dweeby weather guy for the Air Force gets a knife and kills four Russian soldiers in front of the Marines and impresses them. And that doesn't happen in this book. It's not that kind of book. Beck is forced back into future battles, but the only person he ever kills is his friend. Even though he actually plays a really pivotal moment in what is probably world history by his actions in a fight, he can never say, "Yeah, I was a real hero. I was a true warrior."
Completely. And I think it's really nice how his arc gets finished, in that he basically learns his lesson and he goes home at the end.
Yeah. And he's the only person who does.
Boy. I also think there's just a really nice cruel irony, because he went, like, he left home because he wanted to prove himself a man. He wanted to, like, grow up. And when he comes back, you're just like, yeah, you did grow up. You lost all that childhood innocence.
More than that, I'd say. Yay. The reason why he's, like, grown up is that, you're right, he's learnt his lesson. And it's not that war has made him into a man, which is a disgusting idea that persists even into the modern day. It's the fact that he sees things how they are. You know, he realizes that, like, living on a farm with his mum and his little brothers, like, it's a good way to live. You know, it's like, that's, like, you know, that's just as much a man's role, and it's a sane man's role. It's the opposite of, like, what you learn at the start of Best Served Cold, when Monza, her father's farm, is burnt down. She says, it's so much easier just to steal from other people. And for Beck, it's not easier. He's given his reward money at the end, and it's a lot of money. And he says, I can't take that. And he refuses it. And no one else can understand why.
I think that's also really nice, just to shine a light back on that previous character of Monza. Because that was a character who killed so easily and made a point of, oh, it's so easy just to physically to slit this man's throat. Very dark, I know. And so it's nice to have a character that has humanity. It wouldn't be defined as a sociopath by modern definition. So yeah, that's nice to see.
It is nice and rare in a Joe Abercrombie story. However, we have spent a lot of time talking about Beck, the person who has, like, the second least amount of, like, page count in terms of, you know, taking up the theme of the book. So I think let's speed through the next one a little bit faster.
Very well. Let's jump back over to the Union side and talk quickly about Finry.
Yeah. So Finry is the sole female perspective in the story. Everyone else is either a man or a little boy. And so, but Finry actually provides a really great different view of the battle, because she's the one person who never gets involved in a battle of any kind, or even like a marching maneuver of any kind. She's supposed to have the political lens from the Union side. She's the one who can see a larger picture. She understands why characters are doing what they're doing. She's the daughter of the Lord Marshal. So she's at the battlefield because her father's there and he's overseeing the whole campaign. And because her husband is an officer. I can't remember what his exact rank is. It'll be at the front of the book. There's a huge glossary of characters at the front of the book. And I haven't needed a glossary this bad since I read The Silmarillion.
It's safe to say, whatever his rank is, it's not high enough.
Right. Finry is extremely... She's described as being venomously ambitious. The whole reason she's come here is not to win the battle. It's to make sure that her husband does all the right things to get himself promoted.
I think this is a really fun character. It's a really fun other element to war and conflict. The fact that you're looking at these organisations, and they are organisations, and there are ranks, and there are promotions, and there are pay rises. There's a sense of almost corporateness to the other side. So that's kind of really fun to see. The fact that she kind of, I don't say disdain, but almost like disinterest on what's going on over there, over on the other side of that field, is really cool.
That's right. Just like Beck, her arc is to change her perspective on war. She's using it as a tool for political gain and personal ambition. By the end of the book, she comes to learn the cost of war. And it's not by, like, killing a friend. Actually, no. It's about vicariously feeling the suffering of others. Her husband is wounded. Her, not exactly a friend, but, like, the only companion she has is taken as captive by the enemy. And we never find out what happens to her. It's left to both ours and Finry's, like, dread imagination. And then at the end, she, like, starts caring for the wounded. And it's full of these vicious, hideous wounds. And she has a great confrontation with Gorst at the end. But I'd like to hit that quite a bit later, actually.
So let's now jump, once again, to the other side. Do you know how we're going back and forth to each side of the battlefield? Not only is that a great thing with the POVs in the book, as we kind of rotate round, there is actually, and now we've got to the midpoint of the POV characters, I'm going to talk about this chapter. It's not quite the midpoint of the book, maybe the first third, but gosh, Geordie, this is the best written chapter. I loved it. I thought the idea was great. So much fun to first read it. The chapter's called Casualty.
Go ahead, Duncan.
This is the chapter, and this chapter marks, like I said, about a third away from the novel, the actual start of like the main conflict. This is when the armies are finally going to clash. And
it takes a while
to happen. It does take a while. The build-up is really important, but here it is. It kicks off, and we follow a new POV. And I'm like, oh, hello. Who are you? That's nice. Oh, you've got your ideas of war. You've got a ring with your betrothed's picture on it. How lovely. Oh, how are things doing?
I love that because it's like an old-fashioned version of like the locket a World War II soldier has around his neck 10 minutes before he dies.
And 5 minutes later in this book, this character dies. And I was like, oh my God, wasn't expecting that. What a cool way to kind of kick this off. I love the fact that we get so much of this character by the way in just a few paragraphs. He's like, oh, I wish I spent more on my sword and not my foppish hat. Oh no, we've been flanked. What do I do? You know, you get all of his thoughts and experiences, what he thought it's going to be like war, how it's the reality of it. His troops are abandoning him. It's actually a pain. He gets cut down and then there's a little break in the page and we jump to a northerner who goes, and then I hit that foppish idiot again on the head. And we get his perspective. And we do the same again. We get a little bit of his life. And they're about to storm.
And so it goes throughout this chapter, swapping back and forth as characters kill each other. Their murderer becomes the new perspective character.
Loved it. I loved it because I wasn't expecting this. And each time, I think they even get shorter, the sections. And you obviously realise what the pattern is. But he's still, Joe O'Connor crams so much into who this person is. And you're like, oh, you're going to die.
Yeah. And a great part of this is that you start to recognise characters. Like, you're in the clamour of battle. And like, you meet someone called Rose. And that person dies. And they're killed by someone you don't know. But then you're like, oh, shit. I do know this guy. This is like, this is Craw's friend. And now Craw's pal is hacking people down and charging through the battlefield. And you're like, wait a second. But I know how this chapter's going. Oh no! Craw's friend's gonna die! And he does. And the great thing about this is that this keeps going until you get... like, and what's really great about this section is that not only do you jump between characters, it actually carries over multiple battlefields. As people are routed and as they run away, it moves from like the top of the heroes to like the river and a whole new battlefield starts. And that means that Gorst, one of the main characters, like he's in the inner blurb. That's how main of a character he is. He becomes a perspective character and you're like, oh my God, is he going to die? Like he hasn't been properly tested in battle yet. And then that makes it a really tense scene because normally I wouldn't believe that a main character in this particular battle is in danger. But the whole gimmick of this scene is about the fragility of life. So even though he's fighting real hard and he's killing a lot of people, when like Golden Glamour or whatever he's called shows up, you're like, oh shit, that's a named man. He might really be in trouble now.
Now, spoilers, Gorst doesn't die in this scene. He is the final one when finally the two sides decide to separate for the day's fighting. And what I love, the way this chapter ends, I think is so fantastic. Because I think it could so end with, like, you know, a real focus on, you know, the fragility or the horror. I just love that it ends on Gorst as like the two sides pull apart. Basically going, oh god damn it. Oh, I was just getting into that.
I was getting a proper kill streak. I was about to get an attack helicopter.
And I think that's just a wonderful bit of kind of dark humour Joe Abercrombie just kind of sends slinging in there. That just makes the whole chapter, it is like intense and there's a lot of emotion. But he does just keep it, it sounds weird to say entertaining. Reading a book about war, I am still looking to be entertained. I think it just lightens it slightly at the end to go, okay, I can still have a little bit more fun with more of the action-y bits of this. And I thought,
let's, I want to... I'm going to hone in on what you said about the book being entertaining right at the end. I think that should be the last thing we talk about in this book before we go to, you know, what we're reading next time or whatever.
So,
because this is an anti-war book. Like, it's about the fragility and the horror of war. And I think one thing we should talk about at the end is that even possible? But long before we get there, and before we move on to any other characters and keep talking about Gorst or whatever, I want to raise a criticism of this chapter.
Criticism? I thought this was pretty top tier. What's your issue, mate?
Well, my issue is only like 40% with this chapter and 60% with you, Duncan Nicol.
Oh, no, what did I do?
When you were reading this book last year or whatever, you told me that the entire book was like this. You said that the book was, every time a character died, it swapped to their killer. And my impression was, it was about this whole chapter, like, as an entire book. Like, the entire battle was about swapping sides, not because you had perspective characters on different sides of the battle, because people kept dying and being replaced. And I was really interested to see how someone would write that book.
Well, maybe I'm prone slightly to aggrandize ideas. Wouldn't that be a cool book, though? Geordie, you can go and write that.
It would! Maybe. It sounds hard. That's why I was really intrigued. I'm like, Joe Abercrombie is a great writer from what I've seen. That sounds really difficult, though. You need to get invested in these characters pretty fast.
Oh, gosh. What? I don't even remember this conversation, Geordie, but clearly, if that was your expectation for the whole book, that must have been shattering.
I was really confused at the start. I'm like, man, it's swapping characters a lot. Maybe it won't kick in until later. But it never did. I mean, it did, but it did it for two chapters. It went for this chapter and for one other chapter, where it wasn't like people killing each other over and over and over again. It just so happened that, like, a new character is introduced as a perspective character, and then they're killed, and their killer became the perspective character. But that character then wasn't immediately killed.
It's a cool idea. I never, when I was actually having this conversation with someone, apparently, like, they're like, oh yeah, they did that in Call of Duty, and I'm like, please, let's not debate.
They did, yes. The World War One game.
This writing.
You were playing, it was like the British versus the Germans, and whenever you were killed as a Brit, you swapped over and you joined the German side. But it's like literally one mission in like an otherwise completely normal Call of Duty game where it's like, okay, now just get back to killing the bad guys.
So talking about killing the bad guys, Gorst, we mentioned him several times. He likes killing people.
Yeah, this dude is a pretty big departure from every other character in the book because he has pretty much no redeeming qualities. And yet he's sort of the most traditionally heroic character in this entire book.
He's the strong fighter, you know? He's the guy, there's a bit in his introduction where he's like, I don't wear all that hefty armor, I just take the bare minimum I need. One gloved hand, one sword.
I'm looking after my parents, Dashund, and she's just woken up, so she may start barking.
Tiddy has a little ramp to get on the sofa, it's adorable. Right.
Actually, the ramp broke because my dad stepped in it, so now she has to be picked up all the time.
Oh, no. So yeah, this is much more traditional. In fact, I think it's good that all the characters are there though, because then we can actually really see Gorst in his true light, which is, particularly coming off Beck, absolute sociopath. No problem with killing people.
In fact, he's more comfortable murdering people than he is like speaking up in a conversation.
Yes.
It's like if John Wick had social anxiety.
Not gonna lie, I actually really liked how these bits were written as someone with autism, the level of social anxiety he has when he's like trying to talk up in like a planning meeting. I'm like, ah, I feel you, Gorst. I'm there with you, buddy. I love the fact...
What's interesting about Gorst is that so much of what he does physically is supposed to be impressive and cool. And it is. You know, he's fighting like a horde of barbarians. And he gets, you know, like says like, I killed 15 men today and I could have done more, but everyone else gave up. But in every other way, he's not physically appealing. He's ugly. You know, he's described in such a way that, like, he's clearly, like, physically repellent. And most interesting of all, he has like a very high-pitched voice. It's described as a falsetto, and he's embarrassed about this.
It's such a mix of feeling bad for him and also sometimes sort of joining in the disdain. Gorse has a lot of self-pity. You know, he's sort of very much aware. He self-describes himself a lot as not being very attractive, having an embarrassing high-pitched voice. A lot of his sections are focused on the fact that he's been put here at this part of the war as effectively punishment. He used to be the king's bodyguard, but he fucked up. Not Fidea's fault. And now he's sent here to basically write letters home to His Majesty about how great the war's going on.
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that, but you're right. He's there as the king's observer. He's not even supposed to fight, which is interesting because, you know, he's the person who kills the most in the whole book, but he's not even ordered to do it. He's just doing it because he wants to. And there's a great amount of humour in the extremely eloquent and positive way in which he writes the letters to the king, and then a absolutely hideous slap of reality as it cuts to his narration, and it's like, the rain was dismal, it turned all of the roads to slime. Things crawled along at a pitiful pace.
We spoke in Best Served Cold that a great thing that Joe Abercrombie does is have the characters think something and then immediately say something in complete contradiction. And Gorse exemplifies this. His internal monologue and what he says to the other characters never matches up. Particularly talking to like the superior generals, he'll always be respectful. And then his brain will just be like, you absolute foppish twit.
Yeah, it's venomous and it's hateful. And when it comes to Finry in particular, the one like woman perspective in the book, before we even figure out if she's going to be like a perspective character, in the inside, he's full of like loathsome attraction to her. Like he's deeply infatuated with her in like a really ugly, hideous way. And you know, you're often and the great thing about this is that, you know, it's, you can be like, oh, this is horrible, but you never have the impression that like he's gonna do anything bad. But mostly because he's just like a pitiful coward and he can't say anything. And one time he like does at the end of the book, it's just embarrassing. And it just takes away everything about him that you could ever possibly respect.
I think this is great talking on the tropes of sort of the warrior hero. Because it's like saying, what happens when you take this sort of... I'm just thinking comparing to like Druss the Legend. And what makes a character like Druss... truly in David Gimmel's Legend and related Dresnier book series. What makes him so good? Like, we don't love him because he's a great fighter. Like, that's often quite, I think, confused. It's similar, I would say, a bit with like a Conan character. I've always got to reference Conan. You don't, as a reader, really enjoy them because they're this incredible fighter. You might just enjoy the descriptions of the fight scenes, but it's not that they're a great fighter that makes them enjoyable. It's that quite often... they're quite charismatic.
Yeah, it's the confidence and it's the bravura.
And the fact that they carry that then into lots of aspects of their life. It's the fact that when Druss is like... it's not that Druss is confident that he's going to be able to kill a lot of people. It's the fact that he stands on the battlements and says, don't worry, lads. We'll take this fight because it's the good fight that needs fighting. You're like, yeah, mate. I'll follow you.
Gorst lacks so much confidence... that he believes that other characters are contemptuous of him, they dislike him, they find him ugly. None of his characters ever say this. No one ever makes fun of him for having a high-pitched voice. Even his enemies, like, who are the most macho man group ever, who are, like, oozing testosterone every time they draw breath. None of them make fun of him for having a high-pitched voice or being ugly. And Black Dow says, hey, you're such a good fighter and killer. You should join our side. And it's like, yeah, he would fit in so well over there. But he just gets in his own way all the time because he's so simpering and pathetic.
And I know that always sounds like now we're being mean to the character.
Which he deserves.
Yes, I think that's a very good line to mark. He is not nice to people.
There's a bit at the end, he goes looking for Finry's husband. Because he's hoping that he turns up dead. And when he's the one to find him, he, like, is immediately starts strangling him to death until he's caught, in which he just checks, pretends he's checking his pulse. yeah, he's loathsome and pathetic. But there's also this really interesting part of that very scene, which is after he walks away dejected, like he hears someone calling for help, and he picks up like the log that's crushing this guy with his prodigious strength, and he rescues this guy. And the guy's like, oh, bless you, you good man. And he feels nothing because he doesn't care. And he's being heroic in so many ways, but he's so despicable on the inside that it just doesn't matter. He's incapable of actually being, like, good or true.
Another fun thing, just while we're still on Gorse, is that Gorse has a great relationship with the character of Cold Shivers. Because Gorse is one of those great examples. You talked in Best Served Cold, the character of the cripple, who's a very, it's a completely minor background character in that book, but he's one of the main POVs in the original trilogy. And Gorse is one of the minor background characters in Best Served Cold.
And you're waiting for the moment where he and Cold Shivers are going to run into each other, because if you've read Best Served Cold, you're like, oh, this is that guy. He's the guy who got knocked down the stairs and like got like humiliated. And he's the fall guy for Cole and Monza's plan. And you're like, are they going to run into each other? And if he does, is he going to recognize him? And they do run into each other. And he does start to recognize him. And he specifically starts to recognize him at a point where they're at like a peace treaty. So it's like, this could literally reignite the war if he can't keep it together. And when he like goes up and he grabs him and he shoves everyone else out of the way, he says like, have you ever been to Styria? There's this great moment, because Cole is a guy who could absolutely, knowing that peace is on the line, could say, oh yeah, it was you. Fuck you. And then completely start the war. So there's a serious moment of tension before Cole goes, nah, never been there. And that's the end of it. And Gorse just gets shrugged off and shoved to the side, and people even forget that he said a word.
It is a great anticlimactic ending for this character. And I think it suits that kind of pathetic undertone just perfectly. But let's leave Gorse. Let's leave the Union for a bit. And let's spend some more time on the other side with the Northmen. Because there are two other key Northmen POVs that we have. Let's touch on the maybe lesser one first. And then we'll go for the guy who really brings us to the end game. So the lesser one is the actual first character we ever kind of talk to in this book. Now, I'm a little bit off on pronunciations. This Curdon Crow? Cruel?
Craw.
Cruel.
Because you've got something in your craw.
As I do. Very regularly.
Yes, whenever you try to say a difficult fantasy name.
Craw is, in many respects, the exact opposite end of the spectrum to Beck. He is the very old soldier. He's one of those heroes that people tell stories about. He's a named man, which basically means you have a cool nickname.
Which you've earned. I would disagree wholeheartedly. He's not like the opposite of Beck. He's like the path more chosen. He's what Beck could end up being. Because the important thing to know about Craw, even though he is like a great fighter and he's a good leader and he's seen it all and he's like, he knows he has like good connections to other war chiefs. He's terrified of fighting. Like, he's completely terrified of it. And he's never gotten over his fear of being in battle. And he's in the first battle of the book, even before the armies arrive. He's in the first skirmish.
So is it more the same? So it's not the opposite end as in a different character. He's just Beck at the opposite end of life. It's
exactly. Like,
Beck could get
Beck
there
comes
eventually
to a point where he could choose, what sort of man am I going to be? And he could choose to try and be like his father, and therefore end up being Craw, someone who's been in a ton of battles and has a lot of experience, but is still terrified of fighting, because he'll never get over it. Or he could take the path that he ends up choosing, and being, you know, a good man. Because Craw is always saying, we have to do the right thing. We have to do the right thing. That's his big belief. He's basically saying, you know, like, he's lawful neutral. He's like, we have to follow the code. We have to follow the rules. Even when it's not the good thing to do, it's the right thing. Beck chooses to do the good thing. He breaks, like, the code, the rules.
This very much plays into the fact that Craw is, fundamentally, I think, a bit of a coward. Because the reason why he's like, we should follow the code, is because he doesn't ever want to take a stand for what he believes in, really against anyone else.
Now, that's yeah, I think there's definitely some truth to that, Duncan. I like the way you phrased that, to tie in his cowardice to his, like, willingness to follow the rules. It's not the what I took away from the book, but I do like that approach.
Well, I say that because I also think it ties into his ending, and I know we're jumping head over heels to get there, but Quill's ending is that he keeps saying throughout this book, I'm old and I feel it in my bones and my knees aren't what they used to be. But at the end of the book, he has a similar situation with Sobek, with the fact that he could retire. He could take his pot of gold, yeah, and maybe he could go farming or whatever. But he doesn't. He stays in the
exactly.
life.
And specifically, throughout this book, he's like the tropey character of, oh, I'm just one day away from retirement. He's sending up these huge death flags being like, I could just get out of the game. And so you're expecting him to be the guy who dies in the climax. And there's a really pivotal moment where it looks like, yeah, he's dead. When, like, basically the best fighter the Northerners have is killed in a fight with Gorst, not by Gorst, because that would be too satisfying, but just by a random happenstance where a spear just so happened to stick him because the idiot didn't wear any armor because he thought he was destined to live forever. Gorst turns his attention to Kror because he's defending Iron Dao. Black Dao. And who interferes, who saves the day right before he's cut down, one day away from retirement? It's Beck.
Good old Beck. I was genuinely thinking, if Beck dies for this man, I will not be happy.
But that's the thing. Like, I really like the fact he didn't, because in addition to the fantasy people have of, like, you know, being made whole, of growing up, of maturing through battle, there's also an obsession with dying well. It's all tied up in the fantasy of warfare. And I'm using fantasy with a lowercase f there, but it is still important to this book, with a capital F. If Beck died to redeem himself, that would be just as toxic as if he became like a good person and a better man by learning how to kill people. And Beck doesn't do either. He doesn't die for Kror, and it isn't even kill for him. He gets one lucky hit where he thwaps Gorst with the flat of his blade. He knocks him stone cold and he gets blood on the sword. But that's it. He doesn't draw blood. It's the only swing he makes that entire fight, that entire climactic battle, which decides the end of the war.
So he, going back to Kror, like, I'm really glad he's there. He gives a great perspective. He ties into a lot of other characters. But he's not the main guy. There's just one more bloke.
Is he in the first lore books?
Kror?
Yeah.
Yes, he is in the original trilogy. And I'll be honest, I think he's very much the same kind of bloke there. I'll retire soon. Just you, I'm nearly out, guys.
But yes, Duncan, before I, like, dragged you back to the battle, you talked about the end of his story. And about how, in fact, he does retire. It defies our expectations more than once, because he does give up the game.
Yes, he does give it up. Kinda, not quite. I really enjoy the fact that how likely he seems to fall back into it. Jordy, do you remember the exact scene where he's just like, oh, okay.
Oh yeah, for sure. So this is a scene, again, another scene I saw coming from a mile away, but it's brilliant. I loved it so much. He's retired to do as he's always said he's going to do. He's become a carpenter. He's moved to a little village where they've taken him in because it's good to have a named man around. And he sucks at being a carpenter. Like, and of course he has. He was a carpenter for like 2 minutes when he was a boy. And now it's, I don't know, 50 years later. And he wants to try and take it up again, and he thinks he's going to be just as good at it as he is at fighting. And the answer is no, he sucks at it. And then, who should show up at his door but a character called Hardbread? And Hardbread is the character who he first runs into right at the start, one of the few Northmen who works for the Union. And he's the first person who has any kind of fight in the book. It's between Craw's dozen and Hardbread's dozen. But he shows up at his door, his former enemy, who he's always been very friendly with, and he says, So, the war's over, but another one's starting, and would you like to come with us and join it? And he says, No. I've retired. This is what I've always wanted. And Heartbreak goes, okay, but we kind of really want you to be there, but okay, if not, that's fine. And he walks away. And it's not even a full page later of him looking around his own little hut, which he's built himself, and a promise for the future that he's always wanted, when he grabs his cloak and his sword and he runs out the door saying, Hardbread, wait for me!
I love to know, because I haven't seen this character, I haven't read more books kind of going forward, what does Craw get? Like, it's like he's chasing that heroic death, or he's just terrified to be normal and have to put up with, like, the actual basic things.
I think that's close to it, but I really think the fact of the matter is that he just doesn't know how to change. He spent his whole life doing one thing, and now he wants to try and be something else, and it's impossible. He's caught in a pattern of behavior that he doesn't know how to break. Just like that character I've never read anything about, the Bloody Nine. He's stuck. He only knows how to be one thing, and he, like it or not, scared as he is, he's hooked on it.
I think the only thing that upsets me is the idea that if Craw ends up just ruining other people's lives, at least he doesn't seem to be pulling other, like, young men. Like, if Becca died, I'd be like, I hate you, Craw. I know you didn't necessarily do that or be responsible, but I will hate you for it. So if Flaunty just goes, I mean, he's going to kill people. That's kind of the job, but just doesn't hurt too many nice characters in the way. Fine. Have your soldier's life.
I don't know enough about these books in general to make any kind of prediction. I guess I'd be surprised if I saw Craw in a future book. You know, I don't know anything about Red Country really. I don't know how much it crosses over with the rest. I know that I want to read it, and I want to read it bad, because apparently it has, like, the best duel ever, and, like, The Best Served Cold has the best duel ever in it. So that's really hard to imagine a better one than the ones we saw in that. But hey ho, I guess it's in there. So yeah, I can't imagine he could show up again, right? I think he has to just vanish. He went back to war and eventually it will kill him.
I genuinely can't see. I imagine that's the end of his story. I can't see him having a Cole Shivers style turnaround later. Because he had the arc, and then we got that lovely twist on it.
And his arc is that he can't change. So he can't change subsequently. That's the whole point of his character.
Talking about characters that can't change though, Geordie, the final POV, and the one that I think is one of the best to sort of mark the actual, I don't know, world movements, the progression of the overall story of First Law, and that is the story of Prince Calder. Now,
long live Black Calder!
A little background. Prince Calder, he is in the first trilogy. He is the younger son of the old King of the North, a guy called Bethod, who sadly, tragically passed away in a terrible accident involving a circle, the Bloody Nine, and some axes. And following that, Black Dal became king, because Black Dal also had a sword and an axe to hand at the time. And Prince Calder and his older brother Scale, just to drop, he exists as well, have been kept alive and kept around, mostly because there's enough people who like him for him not to be dead yet. Just about.
Calder's an interesting character, and his parts of the story are probably the most intricate and precise, and probably the closest the book has to a main character.
I'd agree. I think that's why
him and Craw, I'd say, are the main guys.
I don't think it's an unfair amount of page time for being that, but his narrative, I'd say, is certainly, I'm going to say, the most complex and the most driven not by his own personal character arc, but by the events.
Yes, he's got his fingers in so many pies, and he cares a lot about, like, and he's smart enough to know what's going on in different camps and what different people want, what they're trying to achieve. But he gets to have a lot of time spent thinking, much like Tunny. Oh, you know what? We never actually said in the spoilerish section what happened with Tunny and what my great prediction was. And my great prediction was that Tunny would never see battle. And he doesn't. He spent 4 days standing at the edge of a swamp, watching Cole decide, and doesn't do anything. But I love about that is the fact that he stands there watching, not doing anything, is actually super important. It's like a world-changing event, them standing there. Because sometimes that's literally all you need in warfare, is just to put soldiers in the right place.
Obviously, portrayed beautifully for the maps of the book, but what Joyce was alluding to is they're in this sort of position where the other side know that if they kind of charge or make a certain push, they'll expose their flank. So they can't. So they're stuck.
And they're so stuck that Calder has to just sit there and wait as his brother's side is massacred, like completely overwhelmed, and his brother is cut down. And he can't do anything. He has to call for help from an ally, Reed, a man who hates him and wants him dead.
Most of the characters in Calder's story. So just to give a little bit more effect of where his... Because I actually feel like I need to explain this one more. Calder starts this story in bed with his beautiful wife, who I believe he married before his dad died. So he did very well in this marriage.
Because he got married when he was a promising match. And then he fell from grace, but he already had the beautiful and powerful wife.
And Calder just wants to sit here, drink wine, and have sex with his beautiful wife. But he is summoned to the battlefield by Black Dow.
The truly strangest thing about this, is that this appears to be the first happily married couple in either of the Joe Abercrombie books I've read so far.
I think you're probably... I'm just flicking through my mind. Yes. Maybe one other. But you wouldn't have met them. They're in the First Law trilogy.
But yeah, like, Calder has something to lose. And, much like a lot of the other people in this book, he's not a fighter. But people want him to be one. There's a lot of expectations on his shoulder. To be like his father. To be like his brother. To be like all the other men in the North. And be like a true warrior. People keep saying, sometimes you have to fight.
And it's so nice to see a character who just really wants to prove them all wrong. And has, unlike a character like Beck, he has a level of agency. He's high enough up that pecking order to try and bring that about.
Yeah.
And what Calder really wants, besides to stay alive and go back to his beautiful wife, is for Black Dow not to kill him and for Black Dow to be dead so he can be king. Simple. Easy.
Easy peasy. He has the right... but not the power. Not enough people like him. Well, people like him, but they don't respect him. You know, he doesn't have the bones, as they say in the North.
And what we kind of get is a lot of this kind of slight political movements around the battlefield. He's trying to look for opportunities to obviously advance himself and to hopefully see Black Dow dead. And I love that. I think there's a little bit where he's kind of just hoping. He's like, maybe someone else is just going to kill him. There's a battle going on. Fingers crossed, guys.
What I like...
But what kind of drive his spot?
What I like about Calder's story is that, much like with someone like Beck, you're feeling the push and pull of traditional narrative. And you're waiting for him, in slightly crass terms, to nut up. You know, he's saying, I don't want to fight. I want to do anything I can to avoid fighting. And you're waiting to, you're thinking like, yeah. Grow up, get out your sword and start killing people. Because that's what you expect from a traditional fantasy story. You expect the wimp to draw his sword, you know, this Freudian penis symbol. Like, get your manhood out and start swinging it around. And this plays with your expectations a lot, because at a certain point, he does fight, but he doesn't draw his own sword himself. He just comes up with a good plan. And that feels great because you finally get into a position where people can start to respect him and, like, follow his leadership. And, like, yes, he's stepping forward. Now just start killing people. Come on. And then he doesn't. Even when he's, like, being attacked head on by the enemy after his great, like, military victory, he has to rely on, like, his adversaries to help him out. He's calling out for help. Help! Help!
But I think that's so kind of great about him, is he kind of represents, I'm going to say, like, the good king. That's not the case. But the sort of bit of the military side of things, they're like, well, yeah, actually, the leader should be good at the strategy and the tactics element.
He's sort of...
Why does it matter if he's actually good at drawing his sword and getting in the fray?
This is a weird thing. I forget which one it is. It's like maybe the second Song of Ice and Fire books, where Tyrion is obviously really smart and he's a good leader. And he can't, the only reason he can't be king is that, one, yeah, he doesn't have the birthright. But two, like, people won't accept him because he's a dwarf. And they won't listen to him as a proper authority. But when the battle comes to King's Landing, he still gets an axe and he, like, fights and kills people. And that feels weird because, one, it doesn't feel like it's something he'd actually be able to do. And two, it doesn't really suit his character. Like, that's not what he's about. He's not a fighter. He's a thinker.
Having main characters show a lot of cowardice is actually really quite unique. And I found it very refreshing in both Calder and Beck.
The other time...
So, props there,
yes,
Joe.
Yes, absolutely. Love Calder as a character. Again, long live Black Calder. And the reason why I'm calling him Black Calder is...
He gets in the fighting circle with Black Dow. Through a few shenanigans, he's basically accused of attempting to betray Black Dow.
She did.
He's like, I'm not actually as guilty as you think, but I am a little. Here I am.
And let's have a moment to talk about Black Dow, because he is an important character.
Okay, he's not a POV, but you're right. He is a huge influence on the story. In fact, he's sort of the reason this narrative is happening. The fact of the matter is, I'd say here, is that's actually very apologetic to colonial powers. Sorry, the local kings didn't just roll over. How bad of them. But he won't sit down at the table. So he's going to fight. Black Dow... It's a bit hard. I'm quite coloured because I read First Law. So I saw him in the book. So I actually think, Georgie, if you tell me your impression and then maybe I'll give you a little bit of background and we'll see how that kind of marries up.
Sure. Black Dow is a character who's outwardly... he's sort of hyping up everything about himself to be like the uber-masculine northern warrior king. So, like, he swears, and he swaggers, and, like, he's good at fighting, and, like, he commands respect through fear. But actually, deep down, like, you can tell this guy's crafty, he's smart, he's savvy, and he's actually merciful. Like, really merciful. Like, he doesn't kill Calder, even though he is a political threat. Because, basically, he likes him, and he doesn't see him as... Like, he doesn't want to kill him. And he releases hostages who he doesn't have to release. And, like, he wants to sue for peace, but he can't do it without it seeming weak to the other northern lords. And so he has to be really careful about how he explores that. So, yeah, that's my impression. He's basically brutal and scary, but a good, serviceable king for the north.
And the only way he's a weak king is where he feels restrained by the population's expectations.
So how is he in the first trilogy?
First trilogy, Black Dow is essentially just kind of one of the side characters to, I'm going to say, Logan Ninefinger's gang, which includes another character you meet in this book, the Dogman.
Yeah, I figured. Because he talks about being like the friend of Logan, of the Bloody Nine. He says, like, hey, did you know that the Dogman's coming and he's bringing the Bloody Nine?
Exactly, they're all kind of part of a gang. But the thing is, Black Dow is such, like, one of the kind of more side characters. He's slightly, I would describe as the strategist, just barely. And his, honestly, the only real impact he has is that in the last trilogy, the Bloody Nine does kill Bethod. And is like, I'm going to be king of the north. But first, I'm going to do the right thing and go to the South Union lands to deal with the actual big bad guy of this book trilogy. Black Dow, do you mind just, like, you know, being the steward while I'm away? Cheers, mate. And so there's a scene near the very end of the book where the Bloody Nine comes back, and it's one of the close, it's the final scene we see the Bloody Nine in the trilogy, and he comes back thinking, oh, I'm coming back to my kingdom. And he walks in and Black Dal is effectively on the throne and is like, actually, mate, I had some chats with people while you were away and we actually don't want you to be the king. I know you killed the last one, that's how it tends to work, but this narrative works better for everyone. And that's like literally, and then that scene closes.
Really? So you don't see for sure whether he kills the Bloody Nine?
You do not know for sure if the Bloody Nine dies.
Your phrasing is very interesting. I'm disappointed by the fact that you told me the blade itself is not as good as the rest. You have told me before that the opinion is basically that every book gets a little bit better. So I sort of feel a little bit spoiled by the fact that I've like, you know, I've watched, I've read like the best parts of the series so far. And now I'm going to have to go back to square one to sort of get to figure out who the fuck Logan Ninefingers actually is.
The thing is, I said that mostly because, and I would say this to all listeners, if you're the type of person who's in for a penny, in for a pound, and you know that if you read the first book in the trilogy, like, you know, you'll read the whole trilogy, you'll do it, then I think there's no problem signing the blade itself. Due to the nature, I'm not going to lie, of the format of this lovely show we do, where a book's got to be pretty banging to make sure that we keep reading in a series, I wanted to hit off with a bit more of a home run. And I also wanted to test whether or not the Best of Cove was a good standalone. So if you're a listener and you don't know if you're going to, you know, commit to a trilogy kind of regardless, I still recommend Best of Cold as a perfect starting point. But the First Law trilogy, I would probably rank above the standalone experiences. But just that very first book, I personally feel, although it has amazing character work, is a bit slow.
Interesting.
It spends a lot of time setting up the board. Subsequent books are amazing. In fact, Before They Are Hanged, maybe... No, I prefer Best of Cold and The Heroes, actually. But
a good book.
It's the best of the trilogy. They're all good. Come on, the bar's high. But they are not as good as these two standalones, I'll admit.
Okay. We had a bit of a digression there. Calder gets into the circle with Black Dal. He's... He can't win. Like, it's just... It's ridiculous. You as a reader are like, well, you know, anything could happen. Like, he could slip in the mud and fall on his sword. And that doesn't happen. Like, Calder does live, but it's not as, like, fairy tale or ironic enough to be like, oh, and by some mere happenstance of fate, he wins. Black Dal just so happens to insult Call Shivers.
I just want to latch on to, wouldn't actually be out of the way for Joe Abercrombie, because in Best of Cold, there is actually a scene where a statue just falls over. And it's, like, got a sword on it and it impales one of the villains.
Yeah, but they were going, like, to win that fight.
We can have a little bit of hilarious irony in here.
He just so happens to insult Call Shivers a little too much. And Call just steps up behind him, cracks him in the head and kills him.
I think it's fantastic that Call Shivers is in a POV in this book. Yet
agreed.
He kind of has the most pivotal moment.
Yeah, and when you think about, like, the string of events that leads up to this, which is essentially, like, a groundbreaking historical moment, the end of, like, a dynasty, basically, probably a pretty short-lived one, but nonetheless an important political faction, and how this all ties back to, like, what Monza is up to in the previous book, and just so happening to fuck up one guy in particular and letting him live at the end so he can go out and just wreak havoc wherever he goes. Man. And yeah, from this point on, Call Shivers is like the third man in charge. You know, he has cemented himself. He makes Calder king. It's a little bit more complicated now, but we're not going to get into what stranger come knocking because we haven't even introduced him at this point. But there's some interesting politics happening behind the scene, which ties this whole book together in like a really fascinating and depressing way. We don't have time to get into it. It's good. Read the book. Come on. But yeah, Cole Shivers is the kingmaker.
That, just what Geordie's alluding to, that interesting kind of political movement, that is the point, and it's great, but it's almost not what makes it enjoyable. So that's why I'm quite happy to leave that to the background. Yeah, we get this lovely moment, and I kind of really enjoy this scene, because there's kind of this moment where all the Northmen are standing there, and it's like they all just kind of, well, at least one guy, definitely, step forward is like, okay, it's Black Calder now, because, let's face it, that's the cleanest way forward, where we don't start killing each other. And everyone's absolutely like, yeah, let's just not have a
it's the path of least resistance. And it completely goes against all their principles and all their rules, because by all rights, this means Shivers should be in charge, but Stranger Come Knocking has said Calder, and he does have a good claim. And yeah, it's this path of least resistance. It's the power doesn't flow from the crown, or in this case, like, the shiny necklace. It flows from, like, the people's willingness to be governed. The powerful people who are underneath the king say, yeah, let's just pick this guy. And immediately after this, like, the epilogue of the book is about a secession crisis where, like, Calder and Ironhead are immediately butting heads again, and that's led to another war, which Calder needs to put down. And, like, they're referring to Calder as king, even though something really interesting happens right after this, which is, like, probably one of my favourite parts of the whole book.
I want to dive into that moment. So, something that you haven't really talked about is Calder's brother. Calder has an older brother called Scale, who is everything that Calder isn't. He's the traditional sword-wielding hero, relatively speaking.
For the North.
And I love the fact that Scale loves his brother. And it's actually, I think, one of the main things that keeps Calder quite likeable in this book is that he clearly has quite a bit of brotherly love.
Disagree.
He has someone he...
I think there's an extent of brotherly love between them. But in his, like... You know how we keep saying characters in these books say one thing and think another? In his inner monologue, he keeps saying, if only I could get rid of him. You know, he's standing in my way. Once I'm rid of him, then I'll be, you know, then I'll be able to do what I want.
Well, yes, but he changes his mind, sort of, in the last moments.
Well,
I think you're getting...
Yes, I am getting to that, but I want to really hone in the fact that I don't think he does change his mind. No, I felt the need that I had to say, bring up, like, his inner monologue about how there's this element of friction where there isn't brotherly love, because that's what Cole Shivers, the agent of chaos, hones in on. Saying, you know, your brother, we thought he was dead, he's actually alive. No one except you knows he's still alive. I could kill him for you. Then you'd be king. And no one will be able to argue otherwise. And what happens next is that there's this huge period in his head where he's greeting his brother and he's looking after him, and he's in a state, you know, his brother is damaged and broken and he looks terrible. He's missing a hand. It was chopped off by Gorst. And as he's walking him back, you as a reader going, don't do it. Don't kill your brother. Be a good person for once. Just for once. Change. And then the most shocking thing happens. Not the most shocking thing. That's still Beck. But the second most shocking thing is that not only does he not tell Shivers to kill his brother, he gives him the chain. He makes his brother king instead of him.
All of this book is characters making, not all the characters, about half the characters making the wrong decisions or not changing. And it's so nice for one of them. This is, I think, almost the moment which makes you think, oh, you're like the main character. Because he does the one good deed-ish caveat.
Yeah, Craw is the one who's saying, I have to do the right thing, and then chooses to go back to war. Calder does the right thing, who's always done the wrong thing up to this point. Who's always been craven and sneaky and treacherous. He's the one who does the right thing.
Now, it's not 100% the right thing. I said, little caveat, there is definitely an element where Calder is going... Better he be on the throne and me the power behind, because he who wears the metaphorical crown more likely to get his head taken off.
That's definitely an element of it. Yes, it's true. But nonetheless, it's also brotherly love. Like, after this, he helps him into a saddle. He starts to look after him the way that Skell used to look after Calder when they were boys. And this is just such a nice, sweet ending for such a dark book.
Oh, the warm and fuzzies. And everyone else who's alive just gets to go home.
Gorst gets, like, returned to his previous position. This whole time he's been fighting and killing a bunch of people to, like, earn enough renown. And then when the letter arrives that, like, says, I want you back in your previous position, I forgive you for your trespasses, he realizes that it was sent before the battle had even begun, which is hysterical. And he goes to Finnery and he says, like, I've been returned to my position. And she's like, wow, that's great. We've been promoted to be, like, lords and ladies. Like, we've stratospherically risen above our previous station. And so he has to just sort of, he's grinning there being like, oh great, everything that I was made me special is way less special than you. And this whole time he's like, he says he's been in love with Finry. He hasn't, he's been like infatuated and obsessed with her, but whatever. And he finally reaches his breaking point where he expresses that he loves war. He goes on this big rant about how great it is and about how it's the only place where people can respect him, where he has power. And she's sickened by him and she takes him to task and she points out all of the horrible suffering all around him, which she's borne witness to and which she's finally come to understand how dreadful it is. And it's so satisfying to be like, wow, the one time you opened your mouth and you said what was really in your head and people can see what you really are, it's so satisfying.
It's the great bit of justice. And in a story where the, like, the overarching theme is a complete lack of universal karmic justice, it's nice to see it play out on at least character levels.
Yeah, this isn't a book where the good get what they deserve and the bad also get what they deserve. That never happens. Period. Full stop. No one leaves this book better than where they started it. Except, I guess, Calder, but he's also worse off in some ways. There was a strong sense of dark, chaotic fatalism to Best Served Cold, where no matter what characters try to do, nothing they ever try to accomplish really came to pass. And there was an almost air of delightful fatalism where you could throw up your hands and say, what are you gonna do? This time I had such higher expectations for the characters in this book. I really felt like they were gonna change and gonna accomplish something. And so that sense of dim dissatisfaction, with the exception of like Craw's decision at the end to go running off, that's the same dark fatalism as Best Served Cold. That was familiar. For the most part, though, you know, like, you're left feeling like, man, these characters have just been hurt and made worse in every way, and nothing of any true consequence was accomplished in this story. And that has to lead us on to our final topic of, is this a good story about war? You know, is it a good anti-war story, and is such a thing even possible?
Oh god, okay, going to the big guns. So, is this a good story about war? See, I really don't know how to answer that, Jodie. I can tell you this was a good story, and I was entertained. But was it a good anti-war story? I personally felt reading, and you know, context of the fantasy genre, and there's a natural disconnect there. I think it certainly did a good job of giving me almost another lens to look at other more traditional heroic fantasy tales. I think it genuinely did. I think now when I read other books, particularly a good example is when we read Legend, maybe this did give me a little bit of a lens into those moments where, you know, what was the conflict for, the other characters that were dying. But to be honest, I've never wanted to go to war, but I do enjoy reading a lot of literature which features it heavily. So what does that make me?
Yeah, and it makes sense. So much of our language around what makes an adventure hinges around the idea of conflict and war. You know, that's why battles and guns are a feature of so many video games, because it's a really direct form of conflict. It's a space which people want to explore. Call of Duty is a first-person shooter because people want to think, what if I was under fire? Would I be able to handle myself? And the answer we expect to get out of those stories is yes, I would be able to handle myself. And I would change and I would become a better man, and that would allow me to live out my power fantasy. And the same exists for stories where the characters die at the end. So in something like Legend, where so many of the characters die in the name of what might be a hopeless cause, that's heroic too. That's a power fantasy too. It's a fantasy that's also about aggrievement. You know, I'm suffering so much in my personal life, and I can represent that in the way in which these characters are suffering for a righteous cause. All of those books, all of those stories, those games as well, they're all pro-war stories. Because any story which can make you think, yeah, being a soldier would be great, even if it would suck. Stories where people come home in coffins covered in American flags or Union Jacks, despite all evidence, those are pro-war stories too. There's a reason why, when Saving Private Ryan came out, a story which a lot of people consider to be anti-war, like the actual Department of Defense was like, commemorated it. You know, they gave it like honors. They said, yes, this is a good movie about war, because it shows this enormous reverence to the people who went off to fight in a particular war. Arguably, the only good war, World War II. And even though it's full of, like, soldiers being cowards and dying pointlessly and suddenly, yeah, that's a pro-war movie too. People go to war because they see Saving Private Ryan. And they think, yeah, that works for me. People go to war because they see Full Metal Jacket, and for some reason, they just don't get what it's about.
One of the things that I feel is really strong in those bits of media, and something which I don't think you could do in a book format, because ultimately it would be very unsatisfying as a piece of entertainment, which, you know, this literature is entertainment, is the idea of the fact that when a character dies heroically in battle, we always see beyond it. We see the character showing them reverence. We see the fact that the victory was ultimately attained. We see that it was all for a good cause in the end. Imagine watching that, and then when a character, say in Private Ryan, when that one guy gets shot because he's trying to deliver a message, it just cuts to black. Like, oh, that's it. He's dead. That's who we were following.
Yeah. Or what if it's a story where, like, nothing was gained? Like, you die and you fight heroically for a cause, and then you lose. Like, we don't see that often. Like, where not even, like, oh, it was all a hopeless cause. Where it's like, well, what really mattered was what the politicians were talking about behind the scene. Which is kind of what happens in this book. Like, the land gets divvied up. Union gains more ground anyway, even though they lost the war. The question is this a good anti-war story? And I think the answer is still no, for all the reasons I've listed. Like, even though it says war is terrifying, it won't make you more of a man, if you can draw any kind of excitement from that, if it makes you want to swish an imaginary sword in the air, no, I don't think it succeeds as an anti-war story. I really don't think you can make an anti-war story unless you genuinely ridicule the idea of war in of itself. Like a Doctor Strangelove or a Jojo Rabbit. That's the sort of thing I think actually you have to make a properly anti-war story.
I think one thing that some of these, well, really could ram home anti-war story, it's probably if you went hard on the angle that killing isn't good.
I think
full stop.
That's really no. I think it's not enough. I mean, it's not enough to say like, oh, those were real people with genuine lives. Like, that's what the section where they people swap back and forth between, you know, between all that. It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't. That doesn't matter. People know that. Like, oh, those are real people on the other side. What matters is that people still respect the institution of war. People still like uniforms and guns and swords. It's only when you have a story, and I think you come close to with Beck, where it's like choosing peace, choosing to like live a good life is actually more admirable than the weakness of choosing war. That you could come close to telling like an actually anti-war story.
Well, I hope one day, Geordie, we might actually read a book that fully nails that. As for the heroes, I would say, I'm not going to say I disagree with you, because there is definitely this book that it is exciting, particularly in the circle, you know, when Calder's having his duel, in the scenes when they're charging up the hill, that I am just like, oh, isn't that thrilling?
Yes, of course. And Duncan, I want to make something clear. Just because this book doesn't succeed in its goal of being an anti-war book, in my opinion, doesn't mean it's a bad book, or even that there's anything wrong with reading books that are pro-war. Like, I enjoyed reading Red Storm Rising, and I described that to my girlfriend as NATO porn. Yeah, they're fun. There's a reason people read these books. They play these video games. I play violent video games as well, because they're sick. It's fine. Just don't be susceptible to propaganda, like me, who it's impossible to propagandize.
I, on the other hand, are very easy to propagandize and have fallen for all of it in my country. I like to play the war games where your strategy ones, the RTS. I love directing my soldiers. Just such fun. Get those cavalry charges right.
Oh, Duncan, this is all I've got to say. I love this book. It was great. People should read it, even if you typically don't like fantasy. It is dark and it is gritty and it is gory, but not as gory as the previous book. Probably more accessible, to be honest, aside from all the, you know, historical politics. Read Best Served Cold because it slaps. Read this one next because it also slaps.
And once you've read both those books, why don't you read Red Country, Joel Convey's next book in this sort of standalone mid-crawl trilogy thing?
People say it's really good, but it's not up to me when we read that one.
No, it's not.
It feels really good to not have the heroes lurking behind me anymore. Because I wanted to read it as soon as we finished Best Served Cold, and I didn't want to jump in and do an entire series again to only then do another entire series, and then, although I didn't know it was going to happen, do an entire series of Star Wars books. That would have been like 9 of the... How many books do we do a year? 24?
21.
That doesn't make sense. How do we only do 21 books a year?
There's 52 books a year, and we do a podcast episode every 2 weeks.
But we do, but it's 12 months. That's 24 books.
No, but there's 52 weeks.
Okay, I'm scared. That's 21. Duncan, what are we reading next time?
There's 26 books. I can't do maths. I'm an engineer.
Duncan, you're an engineer. What do you mean you can't do maths?
I thought there was 42 weeks a year. Anyway, next month we are entering fully into the spooky month of October.
Whoa.
And we will be chopping and changing things a little bit. Obviously, we will maintain our long-standing tradition of doing Berserk. Don't you worry, it's not even a pick.
Woohoo!
We're just doing it. But I feel like we also need to do a scary book. We need to get into the horror feels.
Yes.
And Geordie, when I was thinking about what scary book I would want to read, I cast my mind back and I thought about a promise that we made long ago.
Do we say we were going to read like a particular scary book?
We did, Geordie, and we didn't just say it to each other. We said it to the author themselves. Hayley Piper.
Right, yes.
When we interviewed them on this podcast, we had just finished reading The Worm and His Kings, and we loved it. We said it was amazing.
We did.
We said it to their face. It's incredible. Absolutely loved it. And it has a sequel. In fact, it has 2 sequels now.
It does. We were a little behind the time. We said we would read that one before the previous one came out. It was a couple of months ago, I think.
It was indeed.
The next one is Even the Worm Will Turn. Is that what it's called?
That is correct. Released in 2023, Even the Worm Will Turn, the sequel to The Worm and His Kings. And I believe the most recent book in the series is The Song of the Tyrant Worm. This is cosmic horror. this is a powerful trans main character, and hopefully this will be just as brilliant as the first book in the series.
Fingers crossed. That was a real unexpected one. Just picked a book at random, which I heard one person talk about online. Turned out to be one of the best surprises that we'd had in the podcast so far. So whilst this one is not going to be a surprise, I'm really excited to see what it's like.
Well, I suppose that's it then. And then we'll just have to wait, Geordie. We'll have to wait for me to pick Red Country.
Until then, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
I've already forgotten our fancy northern names.
You are Blacktooth Geordie, and this has been Merciless Duncan.
Bye-bye.